So the next thing I want to talk about is a very brief discussion of a small but important aspect of the real-time response of those systems that we can study holographically and hydrodynamics. So what I mean by this is, you know, so the thing I just tried to show is that thermodynamic equilibrium of this, you know, CFT stuff, whatever, you know, the quantum field there with the gravity dual stuff, is, you know, is described at least sometimes, at least when it's in the right phase, by this ADS black hole, by this black hole in ADS, where the temperature at which we put the CFT gets related to the location of the horizon. That is, the location of the horizon in the radial direction, which I called z sub h. Z equals zh. H is for horizon. And so a sort of natural logical extension of this statement is that local thermal equilibrium of this CFT stuff, you know, by which I mean some slowly varying deformations of the temperature and therefore density and other thermodynamic variables. So this, by the way, is what one means by hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics of the CFT. That is, one assumes that one is studying perturbations of the equilibrium state, which are slowly varying enough in time and space that the individual, I shouldn't say points, the individual little chunks of the fluid are in thermal equilibrium, but that the thermodynamic variables themselves are varying over time and space. So slow variation of those thermodynamic variables. It naturally follows from these statements that such things should correspond to slowly varying deformations of the ADS black hole, which, if you like, we could parameterize by saying that the location of the horizon becomes a function of time and space, which is slowly varying. And this point of view has been taken quite far, actually. It's been very seriously pursued by many people. I guess the most extensive work is by Janik and Pashansky and Bhattacharya, two Ys, and Manwala et al. Okay, and so in fact, you can show that starting with the ADS black hole and performing some boost on the black hole, that is just literally a Lorentz boost, but one which depends on time and space, you get something which is no longer a solution of the equations of motion. But if you expand in basically expand in derivatives, that thing, you can show that demanding that that be a that new thing be a solution of the equations of motion is equivalent to the Navier-Stokes equations for the motion of that fluid, with some very particular transport coefficients, some very particular parameters in the Navier-Stokes equations. And so more or less what I want to talk about is those parameters. Okay, so in particular, one of those parameters that appears in the Navier-Stokes equation is the viscosity. And so my real goal in talking about the viscosity here is that it's an opportunity to demonstrate this real-time formalism that we developed, and we can, you know, derive this physical property of this class of the plasma made from this kind of holographic CFT stuff. Okay, and it's another example of linear response, let me talk about viscosity for a second. So here's the sort of Wikipedia definition of viscosity. So you take your fluid, you put it between two plates, and let's call this direction y. Suppose y is the separation between them, and I'm going to call this direction x. And one way to think about it is you exert a force, some shearing force, where you exert a force on this plate but not on this plate, in such a way that the fluid will develop a velocity gradient, so that the velocity of the fluid will depend on y. And then think about the limit where this is small. so that so we apply a force and we measure the velocity gradient in a transverse direction, and on general grounds that force is proportional to the area of the plates. I'm thinking about a fluid in three space dimensions, so these are some plates that have some area, times the velocity gradient. And then there's some coefficient here, which is by definition the viscosity. Okay, so that's the definition. And I guess this force per area is sometimes called the shear stress. And you maybe won't be too surprised if I say that the translation between this 19th century kind of definition, I'm equating the 19th century Wikipedia, okay, it's interesting, is it can be translated into the way we described linear response the other day by saying that the source is Txy. That is, we can think of this shear stress as the way it couples to the fluid is, if you like, a change in the background metric. You could encode it in a change in the metric on the spacetime that it's living on, or alternatively, we're just perturbing it by the stress tensor. I guess that's really what it means to exert a force. And the response is this velocity gradient, in fact, is also the operator which is responding is also Txy. Okay. And so, right, so what I mean by this is that we're perturbing the Hamiltonian by some background thing, which is determined by the force, some background change in the metric times, sorry, this is yx, Txy. And this is the metric of the space in which the fluid lives, if you like, some perturbation of that metric. And so the response, the thing you measure, is this excitation value of the stress tensor, which in the limit where the frequency at which you apply the force, that is, you're doing something like this, is that right? Maybe like this. You could imagine it depends on frequency. And at small frequencies, it should approach something like this. So this omega is because we're measuring the velocity gradient, right? That's because we need to take a time derivative of this. There's this, gamma xy, I called it, gamma xy. And so this equation is the same as this equation, but translated into this language. And from this, you could learn that we can extract the viscosity as the limit, as the frequency goes to zero, of this retarded Green's function of the operator Txy with Txy at zero momentum as a function of frequency. And then there's this I omega here. Okay, so this is, so you know, all of this, if you like, you can ignore it. The conclusion is that to compute the viscosity, you can compute it from this retarded Green's function of this particular component of the stress tensor with itself in the limit of zero frequency, and you have to divide by this I omega. Okay, so this is the Kubo formula for viscosity. It's the analog of that Kubo formula for the connectivity that we derived. Yes? I didn't hear you.
Why does it have X sub and a delta? Is it that the delta?
This gamma is the perturbation we're making of the metric in order to describe this force. So it's a so that, you know, we're exerting a force here but not here. Right? So here F is equal to zero. So there's the shearing force that we're exerting, and we could repackage that statement into this statement that we're perturbing the Hamiltonian by, you know, if you don't want to think about it as the metric, that's fine. We're just adding to the Hamiltonian this particular coefficient of the stress tensor, this particular component of the stress tensor with some coefficient. And for purposes of thinking of this field theory as living on the boundary of some bulk spacetime, it's useful to interpret that coefficient as the boundary value of that metric, as the metric on which the field theory is living. But from the point of view of someone who's doing fluid dynamics, they don't really care. What doesn't really care about that interpretation. Okay. The point of this discussion is we want to compute this particular retarded Green's function of the stress tensor in order to figure out what the viscosity is. And so let's do that. So we'll think about, and in fact, I want to think about something more general than just ADS. So here's a very general bulk metric, which includes the ADS black hole, and in fact, more or less any metric that you might want to think about. So there's a time component, there's a z component, and there's some spatial metrics. So you could even study a fluid on some complicated space if you wanted. But I want to impose just the following few requirements. I want only g, only these metric coefficients depend only on z. So the I guess the problem is actually translation invariant in time and space. So this is the first requirement. The second requirement is the metric approaches ADS near z goes to 0. It's asymptotically ADS. Or asymptotically any spacetime where there's some holographic construction. So ADS is the only example I've talked about so far, but in fact, there are some others. So this is just so that there exists a holographic interpretation. And exactly what that imposes on the metric is an important open question. You should figure that out. That's a good homework. Three is, I want there to be a horizon. I want there to be a Rindler horizon. So there's some value of the radial coordinate, ZH, where GTT goes to, oh, I think I lied about the definition of kappa earlier. Huh? It's OK? So yeah, I want GTT to do this, and GZZ to do this. I think that I forgot a 2 in the definition of kappa earlier. I did?
Yeah, previously it was down 2.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I just, there should have been a 2. I think this is the right one. Yeah, so kappa here, I'm the reason I'm writing kappa here rather than just like F prime or something like that is because this kappa is something that has a name. It's the surface gravity of the black hole, which I'm sure you encountered. I want this to be positive. If z is less than zh, do I want z minus zh or zh minus z? Z is less than zh, so I want zh minus z, right? Is that right? Yeah, it's very hard to figure out these minus signs standing up in front of you people. Okay, so this is the condition that there's a Rindler horizon. Right, this is what I mean by a Rindler horizon. Okay, so those are my three criteria that I want this metric to satisfy, and then with under these general conditions, we'll figure out some class of transport coefficients. So and consider in this spacetime an action for a bulk field which looks like this. So it's an integral over the bulk, and there's a kinetic term, d phi squared, and the coefficient here can, I'm going to introduce a coefficient which a priori can depend on z. It's, if you like, well, this would be not a very natural thing to do if you were thinking of this as a scalar field, but you can think of this field, which you know corresponds to some operator in the dual field theory, there's a large class of examples to which this applies. And the example that I'd like you to have in mind is the case where this phi is a perturbation of the xy component of the metric. So this, so that is, I'm perturbing, this h is a perturbation of the upper x, lower y component of the bulk metric, in which case the dual operator is txy.
Sorry, I just wasn't listening. What was the q?
Q, it's a function that I'm sticking there because I want to. So I'm generalizing beyond probably what we need the scope of the calculation that we're going to do. So I'm just saying we can carry this along for the ride. You can imagine some circumstances where the bulk field that you're interested in happens to have some function in its action there. Like, for example, if there's some other field to which it couples, which has some background profile, which depends on z. So in this particular case that I want to talk about, let me erase this. in this particular case I want to talk about, where phi is equal to this, where the operator whose correlators we're going to compute is txy. Yeah, it's txy. txy. The q happens to be just determined by the Einstein action. It's 16 pi g Newton, which in fact does not depend on z. Okay? So q is that, if you like. It's just a constant. All right. So now, remember our prescription. So this is, I'm going to use a very slick trick, which is due to Iqbal and Liu, for computing this, where we don't actually need to solve the wave equation. And oh, sorry, I guess I should say the only important condition in this action, which you'll notice, is that the mass of the field is zero. Right, there's a claim that I'm making here, which is that if you perturb the metric perturb only this component of the metric, and look at its equations of motion, and look at its action, it's just equivalent to a massless scalar field. That the equations of motion that you get from the Einstein-Hilbert action and the cosmological constant are just reduced to that of a massless scalar field. It's actually a tensor perturbation, but it's a tensor with only one propagating component. Yeah, yeah, it's. Yeah, so people who study gravity perturbations have this, you know, it's important to use as much symmetry as you can to constrain the problem, because otherwise there's indices flying all over the place. But yeah, I don't want to get into that. It's a fact. If you write the ADS black hole metric in Mathematica, add some small constant times this perturbation with some frequency and momentum, plug it into the equations of motion, you'll see that the equation you get is just the massless scalar wave equation. It's a good exercise. It's very instructive. I learned a lot from doing it. You too could learn that. All right, so here we go. Remember, our general statement is that the expectation value of some operator in the CFT, in whatever state we're studying, like say the thermal equilibrium state, is equal to the limit as z goes to zero of this field momentum, the field momentum of z. And here previously, remember this is this equation that I said you had, there were a few disclaimers. One of them was that there was this factor of z to the delta minus here, but that delta minus, in this case of a massless scalar field, is equal to zero. The source for a massless field is a constant, so we can ignore that here. So that's one reason that's we're making that specification. So this formula implies that this transport coefficient that we want, I'll call it eta, but in fact it's we're computing some more general class of transport coefficient. We want to compute this Green's function, which is the in linear response, the expectation of O is right. Let me just write this one more step. Remember this linear response equation. This is equal to the Green's function times the perturbation. And I guess there's some convolution between these if we're in the perturbation, which I'm calling the perturbation H, if we're in position space. And then going to momentum space, that convolution goes away. It just becomes a product. And so eta is equal to pi of z and k divided by I omega. That's this omega here, this I omega. Times the boundary value of the source, which let me call it phi again. Oh, okay. If I write this general formula, I should call this phi, right? This is and this is the boundary value of phi. And so here is the boundary value of phi. This is phi of z k mu, and we have to take some limits. We have to take the limit as z goes to zero, right? To take that's this limit, and then to compute this transfer coefficient that we want, we need to set k to 0, right? It's a 0 momentum transport coefficient. And finally, after doing that, there's this 1 over I omega we have to watch out for. We have to take omega to 0. Okay. So the fact, notice, by the way, the fact that there's this 1 over omega, and we're going to take omega to 0, it might make you worry. 1 second. But it's OK, because you see the response that we're looking at, this force, it goes away if there's no velocity gradient. Or rather, it's a velocity gradient that happens, not, you know, the it's not that the density of fluid varies. So at zero frequency, nothing happens. OK, yes, please, question. What pi is? Pi, right. So this formula is from the other day. Maybe I'm overestimating the correlation time. Pi is just it's the field momentum. It's the field momentum of this field phi with the radial direction interpreted as time. So I mean, this is the definition. And so you can figure that what that is from that Lagrangian. It's 1 over q. The 1/2 cancels. There's the square root of g, there's a gzz, and there's a dz phi. Good? We're going to use that in a minute. Yeah, sorry, I should have reminded everyone. Okay, so then we're 2 steps away from the answer. And we're running out of time. We're 2 steps away from the answer. So the 2 steps are 2 steps. First, we're going to look at the behavior near the horizon, and then we're going to propagate that information out to the boundary. And we need to propagate it out to the boundary because we want the boundary value. Right? We need the limit as z goes to 0. So first, let's look at the near horizon behavior. Near horizon behavior. And we need to look at the near horizon behavior because, remember, to compute the retarded Green's function, we need to impose in the following boundary conditions at the horizon. And so the horizon of the Rindler horizon of the black hole, by these conditions, is a regular singular point of the wave equation, just like the boundary is a regular singular point of the wave equation. And near the horizon, it's not too hard to show that the 2 solutions of the differential equation, just plug in the wave equation in this metric and look at the behavior near z equals zh and just expand the coefficients, keep only the most important bits. You can convince yourself that near that point, the solution, there are 2 solutions because it's a second order differential equation. The 2 solutions look like this, 2 pi t, 4 pi t. Where T is the Rindler, is the temperature, which is it's related to kappa in the way that we talked about before. And I claim that these 2 solutions are ingoing and outgoing, respectively. The one with the plus is ingoing, and the one with the minus is outgoing. And this is something you can check by looking at phi of T and Z is equal to e to the minus omega T times this phi of Z. And look at, so I mean, this is something I actually, where Mathematica's manipulate command is very useful. Draw this picture for some fixed time as a function of z, and then as you increase the time, you should watch the wavefront move to larger z. I have to do that to check it sometimes. So I claim that the one with the plus is the ingoing one. Okay. So that's the one that we want to keep in order to compute the retarded Green's function. So we want the solution that approaches that one near the horizon. OK, that was step 1. And then, and further, notice that at the horizon, we're going to use this as a boundary condition. The field momentum, phi sub phi, and k, is 1 over q of z. It's square root of g. So I'm plugging into this expression. Over gzz absolute gtt. So this is just the statement that, there's a g upper zz here, which is going to cancel some of that. And where did the gtt go? Uh-huh. Why did I divide by that? Sorry. I used the fact that near the horizon, these two things are inverses of each other. This was a slip. There's a slippery little manipulation in there where I used the fact that at the horizon, these two things were minus one over each other. Okay, good. I omega phi. So this is a clever way, due to Iqbal and Liu, to write this thing. So this is at z equals zh. At the horizon, this is. And we're going to use this as an initial condition to evolve. This is step two. To propagate this information to the boundary. Okay, so the equations of motion that we want to solve, we want to find the solution where, you know, the wave equation is satisfied, and that determines some condition on the field momentum, because, you know, the field momentum is more or less two derivatives on phi, and so, you know, pi is one derivative on phi, so the field equation is one further derivative on pi. So this is something like, there's a bunch of stuff. There's some k mu, k nu, g mu nu. Try to remember what the field equation looked like. It's something like this, acting on phi. And the point I want to make about it is that as the frequency and the momentum go to zero, all of the stuff over here, because of this assumption, all of the stuff over here just goes to zero. That is to say, in this limit where the momentum is zero, this kind of momentum, the spatial momentum of the perturbation, goes to zero, the field momentum doesn't evolve in the radial direction. Okay. And then the second statement is, from the definition of pi, says that the derivative of phi, which is something like this, is equal to q over square root of g, gzz, omega pi. So this is just the definition of pi again. I'm just putting some factors of omega and moving it around a little bit to think of it as a statement about the derivative of phi, because we want to figure out how phi evolves too. I claim that this also goes to zero as omega goes to zero with fixed phi. Omega goes to zero, omega phi fixed, and that's the limit that we want to take. And the reason to do that is because, so the thing that we want all the way over there, this expression for the viscosity, is some limit, some sequence of limits, as k and omega go to zero and z goes to zero. Of this particular combination of pi over omega phi. So we want this, pi over omega phi is equal zero. And the thing that we just showed by taking these derivatives is that pi over omega phi at z equals 0 is equal to itself at the horizon. That is, it doesn't, if I, you know, this doesn't evolve, this doesn't evolve. This doesn't evolve, this doesn't evolve. And so that means that the value at the horizon is equal to the value at the boundary. This, by the way, is the content of the so-called membrane paradigm, which is some idea that the dynamics of black hole horizons has to do with some kind of fluid, some kind of viscous fluid. And you see this interprets statements about this viscosity at the horizon with statements about the viscosity, with this thing at the boundary, which we know how to interpret using ADS-C of T. And so from this we conclude that this viscosity is equal to 1 over this Q of ZH times square root of G, GZZ, absolute GTT. And this combination appears somewhere else. And this was the reason I talked about this so much earlier, in particular in this entropy density. The entropy density, little s, is the area density of the black hole divided by 4GN. Is the area density of the black hole is exactly this quantity. It's exactly square root of G over GZZ, GTT. That is, so this thing has, this determinant of G has a factor, has a GTT, a GZZ, and then three factors for space. But because the horizon is a fixed time and fixed radial coordinate, we have to cancel out the time and the radial coordinate from that product. And so that's what this accomplishes. And so then you all see that eta over s. Well, eta is related to s by some factor, which if I okay, so let me plug in the value of q. So q, I said, was, what was it, 1 over 16 pi g newton? I think that's the right value. So you see eta is 1 over 4 pi times s, times this entropy density. So one over, this is something like 0.08 s. In that's the numerical value of 1 over 4 pi. And and so this is the statement that the viscosity of this fluid that we get by taking a CFT that has an Einstein gravity dual and putting it at finite temperature. So that finite temperature, you know, it's like some kind of blackbody radiation. We have a field theory with massless excitations like photons. Putting it at a finite temperature produces something like a number density of those excitations, which forms a fluid. And the thing we just computed is the viscosity of that fluid. And something that was done by Kovtun, Sohn, and Sternitz was to compare this answer, 4 pi, there's an h-bar that I've set to 1, eta over s, for various fluids as a function of temperature. And what they find is that nearly, you know, water does this, nitrogen does this, and the thing that the ordinary material that comes close, I don't know if ordinary is the right word, is liquid helium at its lambda point has a minimum of its viscosity to entropy density, which is something like 50 in units of 1 over 4 pi. And the things that, so this is 1 here, this is the CFT with Einstein gravity dual does this. So this is rather exotic behavior. But the things that come closest are a little bit harder to make fluids. In particular, eta over s for the Corcoulomb plasma at RIC has been estimated to be approximately 0.16, that is approximately 2 times 1 over 4 pi. There's, you know, there's error bars and lots of interesting discussion about this result. It comes pretty close to this value, and unitary fermions are estimated to have some value of like a half, so something like 6 over 4 pi. So this is a fluid that you can make by taking a bunch of ultra cold lithium atoms and tuning their interactions with each other to be as strong as they can be using a magnetic field. So this is an example of a strongly interacting fluid that you can make in the laboratory, and it has this entropy density to shear viscosity to entropy density ratio that's not too different from this value. And I guess I should mention that before this calculation, when people were thinking about what viscosity to expect for the Corcoran plasma, they were using estimates based on perturbative QCD. And I'm supposed to say, right, weakly coupled degrees of fields, or the fluid of a weakly coupled field theory, has an eta over s that goes like 1 over the coupling constant into some power. Actually, there's a logarithm also. And so notice that at weak coupling, this is much, much, much bigger than 1. So the shear viscosity of an ideal gas is infinity. And a weakly interacting gas is much, much bigger than 1. And so based on these perturbative estimates, which, you know, were based on some calculation like this, it wasn't really anticipated that the Corcoulomb plasma would be a fluid, that it would behave like a liquid where you could see collective motion. But in fact, this was experimentally observed. And the fact that we have this example of a field theory whose shear viscosity, when you put it at finite temperature, is so small was I think played an important role in helping people take seriously this possibility of describing this fluid by hydrodynamics. So string theory did something good in that example. What it is? Oh, I see. Okay. Sorry. Let me back up just one second. So quarkland plasma is a thing. It's a new phase of matter that was discovered on Long Island, which was created by taking very heavy nuclei like lead and gold, and with this, their electrons stripped off, and accelerating them to relativistic velocity and smashing them into each other. And the thing that gets left behind there's very good evidence that the stuff that gets left behind reaches some thermal equilibrium, and the quarks and gluons that were in those nuclei are liberated. And I guess you make some new ones too. That they're no longer in the confined phase. So it's a deconfined phase of QCD. I guess the most interesting thing that we've learned so far about this new phase, about this object, is that it's strongly interacting. So even though it's QCD at high temperatures and high densities, and QCD is asymptotically free, which means that if you study it at really, really high energies, the quarks and gluons don't interact with each other. This phase that's been accessed on Long Island is not in that regime. It's in a regime where they're still strongly interacting, even though they're deconfined. It's very exciting. That's my summary of the quark-gluon plasma. I guess the evidence. So the two pieces of evidence that it's strongly interacting are the thing I just said, that it exhibits collective motion. The buzzword for how you know it exhibits collective motion is the observation of what's called elliptic flow, which is something. Which the thing that you actually measure is some number distributions of pions and kaons and all kinds of ordinary hadronic matter that comes out when this little bubble of the quark-gluon plasma explodes. But based on the distributions of those things, and how many there are over here compared to how many there are over here, you can infer things about this object that you created. And in particular, the basic statement is when the nuclei collide in such a way that the one going this way is here, so this is the picture head on, then the one coming at it is here, the shape of the bubble of quark-gluon plasma that you create is some sort of almond kind of thing. When this happens, if we assume that this thing is a liquid, that is, it's in local thermodynamic equilibrium, then there's a pressure gradient, just because of the shape, which is bigger in this direction than in this direction. There's some pressure gradient in this direction, which is bigger, just because it's squished in this direction, than in this direction. And that predicts that if the thing really does have a pressure, that you'll see more stuff over here. That at some time later, the thing will expand more rapidly in this direction. This is what would happen if there's collective flow. Whereas if there's ballistic flow, if the particles that are coming out of this thing don't care about each other, the thing will become more spherical. And so they observe this. So this is some evidence for the fact that the thing is a liquid. And then the second piece of evidence that the thing that is strongly coupled, it's called jet quenching. And this is the statement that in collisions of protons, just a few quarks and gluons, where you don't make this medium, there's this phenomenon that you see jets, right? That sometimes there'll be some very high energy collimated beam of hadronic stuff coming out on one side, and then momentum conservation forces there to be a jet on the other side also. And so you have these back-to-back jets. The same events happen in here, but if you look at how often you have a jet over here, you detect the jet over here, ask how often do you also see the jet on the other side, and compare the ratio of how often do you see it. Assuming you see a jet here, how often do you see it here? Compare that between proton-proton collisions and gold-gold collisions. The answer is that you often don't see the jet over here in the gold-gold collision. And the interpretation of that is, this one could have been created near the edge of the plasma, and the other, you know, the quark that was going to produce the jet over here didn't make it. It didn't make it out. It got quenched. It dumped its energy into the plasma. And so the fact that this happens, the fact that this is observed to happen, is evidence that this medium is opaque to the strongly interacting things. And so it's, you know, that's the sense in which it's strongly interacting. OK, I'm not going to say anything more about this, unless you have questions. That's what I'm saying. It's not that high. So asymptotic freedom is the statement that the coupling, if you go to higher and higher energies, approaches zero. But it approaches zero logarithmically, right? You have to, you know, factor of two in energy gives you only a 1/(log(2) in the coupling. So it takes a whole lot of energy until you get to the really weakly coupled regime, and this is not there yet.
So you can still not do perturbation.
Exactly. You can try, but so I'm saying that the estimates of viscosity based on perturbation theory were wildly wrong. Yeah. I think, you know, it may be possible to improve that, but so this is, you know, this is an opportunity for, you know, given that we have this holographic description of certain gauge theories, we can try to use it to see certainly we can compute precisely what happens if we make a plasma from those gauge theories. That's what we're doing here, and people have been working hard to learn about, you know, what we can say based on that about the plasma made from this particular gauge theory that appears in our world, namely QCD. Okay, one more comment about the shear viscosity in this holographic plasmas. It was conjectured by these guys that this value of 1/4 pi might be some kind of universal bound on how small 8/S could be. And they actually had a good reason for thinking that there would be some such bound based on some uncertainty principle argument. But this is not it. It's not a bound. In particular, there are consistent holographic theories where 8/S is smaller, where in particular there's some q of zh that's not 1, that q, factor q there, and there's some examples where there's some parameter that appears here. This is some parameter, some higher derivative coupling in the bulk action, and some deviation from Einstein gravity of the bulk gravity theory, which has been, there are examples where you can find this to be as small as 16/25 × 1/4 pi. So this is the smallest known value of 8/S. And in this particular theory, if you try to make lambda more negative, the world explodes. But there may be some other theories where you can make 8/S smaller. OK. All right. So, yeah, that's a good idea. Right, yeah, actually, Rob Myers was an author of this paper. Yeah good. OK, so the next thing I want to talk about is finite chemical potential. And then, actually, do I want to do this? All right, yeah, let's talk about finite chemical potential. So suppose that the quantum field theory that we're talking about, the CFT, has a conserved current. So suppose suppose there exists a U1 current, a conserved U1 current, J mu. Like, for example, in the n equals 4 supering nulls, there's this SO6 R symmetry. You can pick a U1 inside that SO6, take that to be this current. And so that means, by this correspondence we've been talking about, let's see, there's a massless gauge field in the bulk. And let's, at least in circumstances that we know well, though not always, a good approximate leading order description of the bulk action for that gauge build is something like this. That its bulk action is some integral over the bulk spacetime of some kind of ordinary Maxwell kinetic term. And then, you know, maybe there's higher derivative couplings also, you know, plus irrelevant operators that maybe I won't need to write on first thinking about this. And so, you know, I'm writing this based on the fact that in examples this is what you get, but more generally because this is the least irrelevant operator consistent with the symmetries that we can write down. And so where by F I mean this FAB is just the field strength, right? DA AB minus DB AA. And so the Maxwell equation, just the variation of this with respect to A in the bulk, then implies that near the boundary, the solution, a solution of the Maxwell equation, so this is near z goes to 0, and let's think about some asymptotically ADS solution near the boundary. The Maxwell equation ADS says that this approaches a constant, rather a constant in z times some function of x, plus the subleading term is z over L. You can show that it goes like d minus 2 here, times. And so according to this procedure, we can think of this as the source that by which we perturb the action of the boundary theory, and then this will tell us the response. And in the particular case where, if we think about a constant background of the source here, that is, if we add to our field theory action some integral of the time component of at, the coefficient of that is called the chemical potential, right? That's the definition of the chemical potential. Sorry, I don't mean a, I mean jt. The boundary value of this thing when it's a constant is the chemical potential. And so in particular, the constant bit is mu here, and then the thing over here, the thing that goes here, is whatever is the response of the system to the chemical potential, which, you know, if you like, the thing that goes there is the derivative of the free energy with respect to the chemical potential, which is the density. So there's some charge density that goes there. Okay, a very quick comment that's worth making is I mentioned when we were talking about scalar fields in ADS that sometimes there's some ambiguity about who you think of as the source and who you think of as the boundary. In this case, that ambiguity exists. I can think of the chemical potential as the source, in which case the density is the response. That's called the grand canonical ensemble. Or I could think of the density as the source. You know, the number of particles per unit volume, I could think of that as fixed. And then there's some chemical potential which has some average value. That's called the microcanonical ensemble. And interchanging, you know, going from one of those to the other is accomplished in thermodynamics by a Legendre transformation. And that's exactly the description of this business of interchanging those two, the source and the response. There's some holographic description of the Legendre transformation between those. So far I've just been talking about boundary conditions. If I say that the bulk action is gravity plus this Maxwell field with this action, there's a solution with those boundary conditions, which is a charged black hole, a Reisner-Nordström black hole in ADS. I guess sometimes it's called ADS Reisner-Nordström. I'm not going to try to spell Reisner-Nordström. It has exactly the same form. The metric looks the same as the metric that I wrote over here, this ADS Schwarzschild metric. And the only difference, I'm not going to write it. The only difference is that the emblackening factor takes a different form. The emblackening factor is, what is it? 1, so it approaches 1 as z goes to 0, of course, because it's asymptotically ADS. So this bit is the same as before, except I've given a different name to the coefficient here. And then there's some term that depends on which is like the charge of the black hole. And then the gauge field, the non-zero bit of the gauge field, is just a sub t, and that has the form mu times 1 minus z over z naught to the d minus 2. So you see that is precisely, it's actually exactly of this form with some particular value of the density that you can read off from the solution. And there's a relationship between this q and the other parameters, which I won't write down. So this z naught is f of z naught equals 0. Z naught this function, this inviting factor, unlike the ADS, the black hole I wrote down before, which didn't have any charge, that thing only had one zero. There was just this one z horizon. This is some polynomial in z which can have multiple zeros. Z naught is the smallest zero. It's the zero closest to the boundary. So there's a relationship between mq and z naught which is such as to say that f of z naught is equal to zero. I guess I can tell you what it is. It's q is mu l squared over z naught to the d minus 1 gf times a number. Okay. All right. So this geometry is interesting. And it's interesting it's interesting in many ways. But here's a picture of it. So here's z equals 0. And here's z equals z naught. So this is the horizon of this black hole. And then there's somewhere in the middle, which is something like z over L, the place where z over L is something like mu over t. So this geometry that we're studying now has two dimensional parameters. Even though we're studying this filter in flat space, there's two dimensional parameters, which are the temperature, which is determined by the location of, this is z naught, and the chemical potential, right, which is this mu. So two parameters, two-dimensional parameters, mu and t. And so there's a dimensionless combination, mu over t. And so there's a special value of the radial coordinate, which is this determined by this mu over t. So over here, this is the UV of the geometry. This is the infrared. Over here, by fiat, the geometry just looks like ADS d plus 1. Right? We're looking at a solution, which is asymptotically ADS d plus 1. That is, we're describing a field theory, which microscopically is a d-dimensional CFT. A d-dimensional CFT. An interesting thing happens when, for t much less than mu, that is in the limit where this, this moves that way. That is the low temperature limit. When t is much less than mu, so this function actually has two zeros in general. There's another one over here. Let me draw it. Let's call it z1. So this is familiar from the study of charged black holes in flat space, that there's something like an outer horizon and an inner horizon. And in the low temperature limit, those two horizons collide. They approach each other. That's something you could check just from the form of this function. And in the zero temperature limit, this Emblachnik factor has a double zero. Dum, dum, dum. It goes like a constant, let me call it A for a minute, times z minus z naught squared, rather than a linear zero, which is what happens at a Rindler horizon. So this is a zero temperature horizon. It's this plus some order z minus z naught cubed. And so this is a very special and funny thing, because in that, using that fact, the metric, if you look at the metric, it's just minus f dt squared plus dz squared over z squared over f. The metric looks up to a constant like this. Z minus z naught squared dt squared plus dz. I guess there's a 1 over z naught squared here. Maybe there's some l's I'm ignoring. Plus dz squared over z minus z naught squared. Maybe I'm forgetting some a's also, yeah. Something like this. Let's ignore these factors. They don't matter. The important thing is that there's something squared dt squared plus d something squared over something squared. And it's the same something. Yeah, something, I guess, is not such a great variable name. It's this plus flat space, right? Plus dz squared over z naught squared. So this is near z naught. So this is near this zero temperature horizon over here. So this is in the limit when these two things collide. And this is a metric whose name you know. Can anybody tell me what it is? So let me rewrite it a little nicer. It's minus, let me call it u squared dt squared plus du squared over u squared plus dx squared. What is this metric called? Schwarzschild? No, it's not Schwarzschild. It's u squared there. No, it's not De Sitter. That's close. So this is just flat space, right? This is just R d minus 1. All right, so just forget about that. All right, let me define a coordinate which is y, which is 1 over u. Okay, in which case this becomes dy squared all over y squared. Yes, that's right. It's ADS2. Yes, it's the particular case of two dimensions of the metric we've been talking about this whole time, which in this regime, at low temperatures, in the near horizon region of the geometry, it becomes ADS2 times RD minus 1, right, which is this metric. Okay, and so this is a kind of a shocking conclusion if we combine this with our understanding of the fact that the gravity solution is a picture of the RG flow. It's a picture of the field theory RG flow. It says, so remember, you know, ADS means that there's some sort of scale invariance, right? And in particular, so this ADS2 involves just the time direction and the radial direction, and the space directions just go along for the ride. They don't participate in the scale invariance. So this means there's some new emergent scale invariance in the IR. The fact that there's an ADS2, which, you know, has the scale symmetry, means that there's some new scale invariance. It's new scale invariance, which is unrelated to the UV scale invariance because of the fact that we broke the scale invariance by turning on a temperature and a chemical potential. Right? We added two dimensionful quantities here, which just completely break the hell out of the scale invariance of the microscopic theory. The fact that there's scale invariance here is some emergent phenomenon, like in the real world, right? The way scale invariance arises in, you know, from some pile of atoms if you tune it to a critical point. So this is some new and interesting thing. And notice also that this is this low energy theory, this infrared, so I'm going to call this the infrared CFT. This is you know, I'm invoking again the ADS-CFT correspondence to say that if I have a theory of gravity living in ADS-2 times R to the d minus 1, there should be some dual CFT which has this scale invariance where time scales, but space does not. So it's a non-relativistic. It's a non-relativistic CFT where the scale transformations act on time, but not on space. This is a piece of notation which is occasionally useful, is to introduce something called the dynamical exponent, which is something that a possibility that arises in scale invariant theories which are not relativistic, which means that time and space can scale differently from each other, like this. So this z is a parameter called the dynamical exponent. And the thing we've just discovered is an example of this, but a very extreme example, where this is equal to infinity. So you see, if z is equal to infinity, then x doesn't scale, but t does. Okay. And notice that it's perfectly fine that this theory is not relativistic because the chemical potential and the temperature also introduced a rest frame. Right, and the rest frame didn't go. The information about the rest frame didn't go away. Okay, I need to develop the right strategy here. So maybe, how would it be okay if I talked for another 15 minutes? Could we survive? What's the situation with the food? Okay, the food is absent. Good. All right. So, at least I'm not directly keeping you from eating. There's one more important thing that I want to say, I want to talk about an example of how to use holography in what I think is a positive way. So maybe let me make some comments about holography in general, and then I'll try to work by example. So the general comments that I want to make here are along the lines of practice holography responsibly. So this is like a public service announcement. So that is, I want to extract from the things we've learned some lessons for how to use ADS-CFT. So we're going to come back to this discussion, by the way. There'll be some physical application of what we just saw. So the first comment is critical exponents. You know, these are, how to say, this is something which, when you're studying critical phenomena in real systems, like I was just mentioning, the interesting observables are the critical exponents, right? That's what distinguishes a universality class. But and so you might think, well, we have this machine for studying CFTs. We can use it to compute critical exponents. But this is not such a great idea, because you see, these critical exponents are determined like, you know, like here, you know, this is one of the critical exponents. Here, this happened because we were studying a massless gauge field. If we studied a gauge field with a mass, we would have gotten some different number here. The critical exponents are determined by the bulk parameters, by the parameters in the bulk action. But the parameters in the bulk action are precisely the subject to which the string landscape, from which the subject, the string landscape prevents us from accessing, from learning a lot about. Right? These are precisely affected, the things most affected by what you might call landscape issues. Namely, we don't know what the set of consistent values of the parameters in the bulk action are. And you know, we have every reason to believe that any of them can be realized. And so it's completely useless for predicting critical exponents. So they're deeply affected by landscape issues. So we shouldn't use it to predict critical exponents. The second comment is that, at least in examples, thermodynamics is not so sensitive to strong coupling. So I mentioned, you know, in the Eccles 4 theory and in KCD, even though, you know, we're studying some very strongly coupled systems, thermodynamic observables aren't that different, and so this isn't the most exciting thing to study. On the other hand, real-time things, real-time dynamics, and transport, which are things which are very difficult to calculate in perturbative quantum field theory, and you'll get the wrong answer anyway, are actually very easy to compute in holography, and there's built-in dissipation at leading order, and so this is a subject where some very useful progress has been made, and it's a good idea. So for example, in asking questions about the quark-gluon plasma, this is actually has been quite useful. And then finally, I'm not going to write anything here. So the models, which we know for sure have holographic duals, like n equals 4 Sievering Mills and the infinitely many other kind of similar examples, are very different from a model that you might use to try to understand a solid, right? They're very different from something you might write down as a model of the microscopic physics of, say, some atoms arranged in a lattice, right? These things are very different. It may be that there is a holographic dual of some version of the Hubbard model, but we're far from knowing anything about it. And so for trying to use these ideas to learn something about condensed matter physics, it's very important that we ask the right questions. It's very important that we ask questions that are not directly sensitive to the microscopic structure of the model, but rather depend more on universal aspects of the physics. I don't know what the set of such question is, but one example of such a question, which I still think is a good one, which I've been working on for I guess like 3 years now, is the question of what is a non-Fermi liquid. And so I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about this. All right? And that'll be the end of it. So the goal of this line of work, which is mostly done with my colleague Hong Liu and David Vague and Tom Faulkner and Nabil Iqbal, is to try to understand is try to understand, to apply ADS-CFT to the physics of metals, to metallic systems. And holography for metals. So that's the subject. And what I mean by a metal is a systems with a Fermi surface. And so a Fermi surface is, there's some locus and momentum space. Oh, chalk is crumbling. Some locus and momentum space, this is kx and ky, which, you know, maybe it's round. The ones I'm going to talk about are going to be round, where there are excitations of the system at these momenta that cost the minimum amount of energy. They're zero energy excitations. So lots of massless stuff, which is not necessarily particles. The study of relativistic quantum field theory compared to this is actually quite easy from the point of view of asking about what the possible low energy physics is. So this is gapless excitations on some surface, some codimension one locus in momentum space. So that's what I mean by a Fermi surface in momentum space. So this is to be distinguished from relativistic critical points, relativistic quantum field theory, where at most the gapless stuff, which is the difficult stuff to study, which can, you know, it can do all kinds of crazy stuff that you can't control, is it can only be at k equals zero, right? Because relativity forces the dispersion relation to be something like this if it's massless, and so the only place where you can have zero frequency is at zero momentum. And so, you know, compared to this is really boring. So this is, you know, this is a much harder problem from the point of view of asking what the possible low energy physics is. And in fact, we don't really even know. For those of you who saw last week's colloquium by Semple, we don't even really know what the general description analogous to the normalization group theory of critical phenomena is for such a system with gapless excitations on some surface and momentum space. And so that's the reason that this is an opportunity. You know, because we don't even know what the framework for thinking about such low energy theories is, and so, I won't. Maybe I could say more about setting up this problem, but maybe I'll just say what we did, so that we can eat. So here's the sort of very simple strategy for trying to study this problem holographically. 5 minutes now. Okay, which is suppose that, yeah. I guess I'm not going to use this. Suppose that we have suppose that in addition to so we have a field theory. It has a stress tensor. Suppose that it also has a conserved current, like we were just talking about in the situation where we were talking about finite chemical potential. So this is going to be a proxy for fermion number. You know, a way to get a Fermi surface is if you have some collection of fermions and there's a finite density of fermions, a chemical potential for fermion number. And then let's also suppose that there's some fermionic operator. And this is going to be our proxy for the thing that creates an electron. All right? So suppose that our field theory contains these ingredients. That means that according to this correspondence, our gravity theory should contain a metric. That's not too much of a surprise. It should contain a massless gauge field. And it should contain some spinner field, some fermionic field, which is dual to this operator. And, you know, we want this thing to be like the fermion, like the electron, so it should be charged under this current. So this thing has some charge, which I'll call Q. And this thing has some dimension. And so this thing has some mass, which I'll call M. And so these are some parameters which, you know, are handed to us by some theory of microphysics, but we can just think of them as parameters. And so we want to study some system with a finite density of this charge, which, you know, will be analogous to having a finite density of fermions. And so let's turn on a chemical potential for this charge. And when we do that, at least with some assumptions, but the assumption is that there aren't other operators that get involved in the story, the ground state of the system is this Reiser-Nordström ADS charged black hole that was on this board right before I erased it. And so to study whether or not there's a Fermi surface, I guess, okay, so let me mention one observable So an observable to detect, to see a Fermi surface. This is not the way that, not the simplest way, but it's the conceptually simplest way, is the following. Here's your system. It's got your complicated state of your many body system in it, but it's made of electrons. And here, a way to tell whether there's a Fermi surface is you send in some photon whose frequency and momentum you know. Let's call this omega 1 k1. And by the photoelectric effect, you can kick out an electron. You really remove an electron from the system. And then you detect that electron with your electron eyeball. And you measure its frequency, omega 2, and its momentum. So this procedure, by the way, is called angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy. And people actually do this. And the reason that it's interesting for us is that the fact that an electron came out here means that you created in the system some excitation with the quantum numbers of an electron whose frequency and momentum, by frequency and momentum conservation, is the difference, omega 2 minus omega 1 and k2 minus k1. And in order for this to happen, the system has to have a state with the single thing with the quantum numbers of the electron with this frequency and this momentum. And so the intensity of electrons that you see with some fixed frequency and momentum is determined, it's only non-zero, if there's some non-zero spectral weight of the system with this frequency and momentum. That is, I'm using the Kalin-Lehmann spectral representation of the Green's function now. That is, if this is proportional to the imaginary part of the Green's function with this frequency, omega 2 minus omega 1, k2 minus k1. OK, so that last step was maybe a little fancy. I'm using the fact that this decomposition, which I think you should learn in quantum, when you learn quantum field theory, that you can write the Green's function in some spectral representation as a sum over energies of some spectral density over some, this is Green's function as a function of frequency, or something like E minus omega, something like this. Is this a familiar form? In a relativistic theory, you write it as M squared. So this is something like, this is P, this is P, this is something like P squared plus M squared. Something like this. Is this familiar? Yeah? Good. And then this thing you can show is the imaginary part of the Green's function. All right? And so I'm using that here. I'm saying that the imaginary part of the Green's function is proportional to the spectral density. Okay. And so all of this is to say that to detect a Fermi surface, right. And I should say, if there's a Fermi surface, then this thing will have singularities at zero, when this thing is zero, and where this thing is on the Fermi surface. In particular, and if it's a Fermi liquid, it'll be delta functions. It'll be a delta function at the Fermi surface. Okay, and so to see whether this system that I just described, so with finite chemical potential, it's a spinner field propagating in the resonant Roentgen black hole, to see whether that thing has a Fermi surface, we can just compute the retarded Green's function for the electron operator. So this GR, I should say, is the retarded Green's function. Here, by this I mean the retarded Green's function for the electron operator psi. Okay, and so this is something that we can do just using the machinery that I've described. All we have to do is solve the wave equation for the spinner field, which is in the bulk action, there's going to be some term which is some kinetic terms for the spinner field. I'm calling the spinner field little psi. There's some d slash minus m. This d slash involves, this Dirac operator involves some coupling to the gauge field. And so all we have to do is solve this Dirac equation, this equals zero, in this ADS black hole background. And okay, so this is something that it's not too hard to teach Mathematica to do. And the answer is that you find a Fermi surface. And the excitations near the Fermi surface are, in general, very different from the excitations of a simple Fermi liquid, a Landau Fermi liquid, which is the case of this story that's understood. And it, so in particular, it's a non-Fermi liquid. It's something other than a Fermi liquid. And okay, maybe since we're out of time, I'll just say, by thinking about this picture of the geometry that I described, the fact that there's this infrared CFT, one can develop a very detailed understanding of the low energy physics of the system near the Fermi surface, and in fact can analytically understand the behavior of the Green's function near the Fermi surface, and one can also compute transport properties that arise from the excitations of this Fermi surface. And in particular, this leads to some interesting picture of a system with a Fermi surface which has, if you like, very efficient current dissipation, which is a requirement for understanding certain non-Fermi liquids that exist that have mystified people for a long time. And so it suggests some picture which hadn't been thought about very carefully before, for how one might understand the low energy physics of such non-Fermi liquids, which one can extract from the description in terms of gravity and anti-de Sitter space, and the details of that picture, and you know, in the end, the thing that one gets from this description is some very simple picture of basically how to turn a Fermi liquid into a non-Fermi liquid of this kind, which can be studied on its own terms. So I think this is a positive consequence of this holographic study of non-Fermi liquids. And more generally, trying to apply holographic duality to learn something about physics, and in particular condensed matter physics, is it's a very tricky business, in the sense that it's, you know, one can't just straightforwardly apply the models that we understand to compute things about real systems, and really a lot of the difficulty is in finding the right questions. And so this is one example where maybe something there was a positive outcome, and I hope there are many others, but I'm not sure. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Oh, very nice.